Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Mobility Radio, featuring industry leaders and innovators in mobile technology.
Good morning, this is Brett Cooper here. A couple of great folks in the studio this morning to talk about mobile and the Atlanta mobility scene. Start out with Dan Israel from Razorfish is here. And Dan, can you tell us what Razorfish is? I know you guys are an agency. I know a lot about you, but on the surface, for the mobility space, what are you guys working on that's cool these days?
Sure. Thank you very much, Brett. So Razorfish is a marketing and technology services company. A lot of what we do is we help companies transform their industry. We're called on oftentimes to help companies figure out how to bridge the physical and digital worlds that they operate in. So mobility plays a central part in making that happen. What are the right experiences that are optimized on whatever device people are using to interact with the brand? That could be in the store, on a mobile device, on a tablet, in a kiosk, online, offline, and everything in between.
Nice. A lot of the taking marketing and thinking about how to get brands, get customers engaged on mobile and also the web.
Absolutely.
And for you guys, is there anything cool you guys are doing with mobility right now? Do you see there's a lot of uptick in the last few months?
Yeah, and not only is it cool, but it's also very cost effective. There was an effort by Mercedes-Benz last year. You may have seen the release of a new vehicle called the CLA. This was showcased during the Super Bowl. What was interesting is they weren't going to release it for another 8 months. So how do you get momentum and raise awareness, particularly with a segment of the population that may think that Mercedes was their grandfather's car? So what we did is we came up with a campaign that really leveraged the medium that people that is a target market use, and this is Instagram. So what we did was we identified the top five photographers on Instagram. Mercedes-Benz gave each of them a CLA, and there was no business brief, nothing written. They basically said, just take photos, and whoever acquires the most likes for all the photos that you took, you would get the car. So, you know, there were no touch-ups on photographs. There was no brief about what they needed to say. It was totally open-ended. This gained a lot of traction. And what was interesting is they got a number of, you know, the number of assets they got without having to touch up photography, the awareness they got between the really under the 34-year-old band. It was a fantastic success, and it was one of the most cost-effective marketing campaigns that Mercedes-Benz had ever done, and we even won a Smarty Award for it. So that was something where we knew where the audience was. Instead of forcing them to go where we wanted them to go, we went to where they were. And Instagram was the tool, and Instagram is on mobile, and this is a very effective campaign.
That's pretty cool. And you mentioned that word medium in there. When you think of medium, I always think of the traditional. You have pieces of paper or billboards, and it became web and now mobile. What does that mean to you guys, and how do you go from the gap of a physical medium to the digital assets you guys are working on?
Well, I'm really glad you said it wasn't a TV show on NBC. Actually, the medium that I'm referring to is whatever individuals are using to interact with a brand. So a medium could be a smartphone device. A medium can be a tablet. A medium can be a PC. A medium can even be a physical asset, such as going into a store. It's whatever people are using to interact with your brand.
How do you guys perceive the ability to go from inundating people with just tons and tons of ads versus having that Instagram example you gave is really good because it feels like that's natural for people and got people excited and engaged. But what's the trick for companies to try to avoid just throwing up the examples of the banner ads from the late 90s?
Well, banner ads are, as you said, it's a relic from the 1990s. It sounds weird to say that, but you hit on a very important point, and it's you have to have authenticity in what you provide, because now people have become the creators, producers and distributors of their own content. And what that means is that they get to define what the value proposition is of a brand without you, the brand, having the ability to state what the messaging is. With that being the context, then you as a brand have to say, look, you know that we can't control the message, but we want to show you that we're authentic, that we're real, and we're going to let you pick up an experience where you left off before. The example I give oftentimes is Evernote. Evernote is, for all intents and purposes, it's a filing cabinet in the sky. And what Evernote does is, whether I am using my smartphone, if I use your 6 plus there, or 6 mega plus, whatever you have, that I can access my content from wherever, and I get to pick up the experience where I left off. So from a back-end standpoint, that means that you let people pick up where they left off, whatever medium they're coming in on, and you also want to be authentic. You don't want to tell the customers, this is what you have to think, this is what you have to believe. That paradigm no longer exists. We have to realize that control is completely in the power of the customer today. It's no longer really as controlled by the brand. There is some, but you know, you quickly get the emperor has no clothes very quickly. Yeah. When you try to shove it down the throats of the consumers.
You mentioned earlier the different segments between the 35 and under being hard to reach. For you, I know the millennials are a big target for a lot of companies, and I think there's been a bit of a struggle, and it seems like that's where mobile is starting to pick up. When you think about those demographics, how do you guys perceive? Is it under 25, 25 to 35, and then old people, or what's the categories there?
Well, I think really there's some certain fault lines, as I call it. I think the first natural fault line is 30 and below, and then you have 45 to 30 or 30 or 30 to 45. For the people under 30, what's interesting about millennials is there is a distrust of everything, whether it is the institutions of government, institutions of the military. I mean, you look at anything, CDC, anything, it seems like there's this massive mistrust on for this segment. And, hopefully they still trust their parents, but, sometimes that's even questionable. And the reason I put that context out there is because there is a desire to see authenticity. Unless there's authenticity, then you're not going to get any credibility. The first sign of you trying to deceive someone, then there's automatic distrust for people in the 30 and under. Now, let's add on there another layer, which is this population has really grown up as what are called digital natives. They have grown up just as we were conditioned to grow up with color TVs, and our parents only grew up in black and white. Now, and our parents grew up with electricity, and others didn't. This generation grew up with smartphones. This generation grew up with always on access to the internet. And with that being the case, if you are not able to let them get the information they want at the click of a button, then you've lost them. And you need to be able to get credibility within the social networks of these individuals. It's almost like the old, I joke with my kids who don't quite understand this yet, but I said, everything in life you can learn from The Godfather. Mm-hmm. So if you watch...
Wait, how old are they? Seven
and eight.
Nice.
But,
Oh, yeah.
But
you guys are watching it again.
But when you look at The Godfather, there are lessons of how you need to think about life. And for these kids, they need someone to vouch for you. They need someone to say, you know what? We think that this is good. And it can't come from the brand or another brand that you're partnered with. It has to come from people within the social network. So now earned media has moved away from the New York Times and Wall Street Journal. It's still there. I'm not saying it's gone away, but the real credibility comes from a social network. So if you want to gain credibility, you have to get it from within the social network. And then the challenge for brands is, how do you get that credibility? I think the example I gave you about Mercedes-Benz with Instagram was, they did identify the top five photographers. But in that model, they didn't tell, we didn't tell the photographers what to do other than take photos, and whoever gets the most likes for all of the assets that you've taken photos of, you get to own the car. That was it. That was all. And that gave the authenticity. And then you were able to gain credibility with the social network that these people operate in. So you achieved your goal of raising awareness. You achieved your goal of showing authenticity. And you're able to get currency within these groups.
So it's sort of implied there, but there's been, I'm guessing, some situations where people have done a really poor job of this. Can you cite one or two of those that you've seen recently with using mobile devices or newer technology?
Well, I'd rather stay on the positive, but I think
we call them lessons learned. Lessons learned.
Lessons learned. You know, let's look at some political campaigns. I mean, you know, honestly, if you look at political campaigns and how social media has been used, many politicians like to use social media to say, you know, this is my position on something. This is what I want to be able to do. This is what you need to do. Vote today, etc. They're not engaging in a conversation. The brands that are most effective to gain currency is that you have a conversation. You're not trying to tell people what to think. That's the old model. And I think this has happened in the retail space. It happened with the financial space. You're starting to see this happen in the healthcare space. It's going to be happening in the education space. The last species that is really getting is understanding this are the politicians. To their credit, the Obama campaign team effectively figured out how to leverage social media to organize, but it wasn't so much to have a conversation. And I think that's the next iteration that the political class has to figure out. And you're seeing retailers do a very good job of that. You know, you look at how if anybody says something negative about Coca-Cola or Delta on Twitter, all of a sudden someone is going to try to engage you in a conversation, not to say, hey, you're an idiot. They're actually saying social network becoming an advocate for you because you paid attention to them and you're showing authenticity.
Yeah, but I think the key there is the authentic. So I've seen definitely some tweets, the Autobot tweets from Comcast complaints. My Comcast is down. Well, thank you for your input. We appreciate it.
Yes.
I'm canceling my service. Well, thank you. We like your service. Yeah, it can definitely go wrong if you're not, like you said, if you're not authentic.
That's right. That's right.
Noticeable.
And really, if you truly think about it, what brands have to do is think about this in terms of a relationship. You know, if you treat someone as just a cursory type encounter, it's not going to lead to something constructive or long-lasting. If you develop a relationship, that involves having conversations. And this involves engaging with your consumers at different points on the mediums that they're used to and in the forums that they populate. Brands can't force a consumer to just go to their app and use the process that you put in place. You know, a brand, you know, you reference Comcast, you can't say, well, look, call us between 9 to 5 and then we'll deal with your problem. Well, you need to provide different options to engage on the terms that the consumers want, because there's a different mindset, especially for those 30 and under. They expect things to get rectified quickly on their terms. And if you don't, then they're going to walk away. You have options today that you didn't have before.
So for you guys at Razorfish, when you go help companies with these types of activities, how do you start those engagements? What does that process look like? So I'm a company and I say, I don't really have a good engagement with, you know, the under 35 markets. And I know they're all carrying mobile devices. I want to have, you know, I'm guessing you get some off the wall questions. I want a mobile app. It's probably a big question you get. How do you guys guide somebody through that process?
And that's a great question. And we do get that a lot. You know, some people will say, well, we need a mobile app. And really the first question is why? Because what we really want to do, there's two things that have to be done off the bat. Number one, it's understanding what are the business objectives. Is it to increase the number of engagements with the consumer? Is it to increase the basket size of any order? Is it to increase the number of new customers? We need to understand what are you really trying to achieve. And then next, we need to get in the head of the consumer so they understand not just what they think of the brand, but how do they like to interact with the brand and how do they do it today? So you with those two pieces, then we do a technology due diligence, as I call it. And really this is understanding, okay, we know what your objectives are. We've gotten inside in the head of your consumers. So now we know what experiences we need to create on the different mediums, on the different touch points. But now we want to understand what technology you have today. So that way we can create a roadmap for here's the experience that we can create based on the technology on the platforms that you have available, and here's what you need to put in place to implement in terms of technology to provide the next iteration of an experience. So it's taking those three pieces. What are the goals of the company? What is going on with the consumers? How do they like to interact with the brand? Where are they? You know, you want to go again to where the consumers are. You can't force the consumer to come to where you are or to force processes on them. That just doesn't work anymore. And third, we have to understand what technology you have available and what technology you need to have in place to enable an optimized experience on medium so you have a constructive conversation and engagement with your consumers.
Awesome. And if people want to engage Razorfish, what's the process? They just reach out to you guys, or do you guys have a website? How do they get in touch with you?
Razorfish.com is our website. I'm in the Atlanta office. Anyone can contact me at dan.israel, I-S-R-A-E-L, at razorfish.com. We would welcome any opportunities to talk with brands and to develop a relationship. You know, I eat my own dog food. And I actually try to have constructive relationships and to develop, you know, so that way I really want to understand what are the pain points. That's the key thing. You know, going back to the sincerity, we want to make sure that any brands that want to engage with us see the value in working with us because we want to really help them. We don't want to just sell something.
Awesome. Cool. Dan, thank you very much. Razorfish.com. Check it out when you get a chance. Next in the studio, Josh Waddell from a small company, a little startup out of was the Germany called SAP. Is that what it is?
Yeah. It's a little startup 40 years ago.
Awesome. Yeah. Thanks for being on today. And you're the VP over mobile innovation. Is that the correct title?
Yeah. So I run a team called the Mobile Innovation Center. The Mobile Innovation Center is actually based here in Atlanta. We do have offices in other cities around the world, but we're based here. We are really chartered with working with customers to identify new trends in mobile technology, see how the new trends in technology could fit into their business, whether it's a bespoke solution or, you know, unique to them using SAP's technologies. And then when we do find trends that make sense to productize, we work with development teams to productize those solutions. So recently we've been working with customers a lot around sensor networks, various types of sensors, wearable technologies like smart glasses, and even watches. So this is the kind of Mobile Innovation Center. We're based here, but we work with customers from around the world.
What is that? So you guys have labs with lots of different toys, and you just have engineers that you lock them in a closet and say, "Go figure this out, and don't come back and talk. No more coffee until you come up with a good idea." How does that process work to actually generate innovation or think about solving problems?
Yeah, I mean the team itself is really great. I would say we're about 90% developers, 10% designers, and we do. There are those occasions where we kind of lock them in their room and give them some cool technologies and see what they can do. We did that recently with some of the recently announced smartwatches like the Samsung S, and that's really fun to watch. But more often, what the process is that we work directly with customers that will have either an idea or a problem that they want solved. And then we go through a very iterative process that we use inside of SAP called design thinking, where we really try to bring in business users, technologists, and put ourselves in the end user's role and try to use a lot of empathy to design a solution around them.
Can you walk us through this? I know at Mobility Live you guys had the example of the glasses and some of the other wearables. Like, can you talk through like what would be a good use case, like when you guys have been looking at Google Glass and the other, the Panasonics and those other type of heads-up display devices. What have you guys tried out, and what is that process? Can you walk me through it?
Yeah, sure. So that's actually a fun topic to talk about because it's one that is really emerging, and a lot of our customers have seen a lot of promise in it. We actually several years ago did a video about the future of warehousing as it could look with smart glasses, and the video. We just put out on YouTube, and the reaction was such that it really was overwhelming even to us. And maybe there was a lot of pent-up demand for mobile innovation in the warehouse or whatever the case may have been, but we got together a whole group of customers, ran through several design. It became kind of larger than a design thinking session. It really became kind of a design thinking academy. We had multiple customers. We created a demo, and then we took the demo to end users, and then we created a beta, and then we've implemented the beta at many different warehouses around the world, including some big brand name customers here in Atlanta. So that's kind of the process, and in the case of wearables, it's been really fun to work not only with end users and designing the software, but also the hardware companies to really understand the current limitations of the software and help them get the glasses to where they need to be.
Would you say the hardware is probably the hardest piece of that, or is it still software?
In the case of wearable technology, smart glasses, yeah, I mean the hardware is still where we're pushing the hardest, if you will. We haven't run into any software challenges that we weren't able to overcome. But even within within smart glasses and wearables, we find use cases where, like for example, in a warehouse, you kind of need them for an 8-hour workday, and there's other concerns, whether it's privacy, labor union rules, and a whole host of other issues that we work through. But there are scenarios. We just launched another smart glasses application for field service technicians. And that solution, it does work quite well because you're not needing the battery 8 hours a day, and there's chances to use it intermittently.
What's the time limit on those devices? I know I talked to Samsung last week, and they were saying for their display, they recommend 30 to 40 minute limits on using it. And I was like, that seems really short. What have you guys found?
Yeah, it varies kind of by device and manufacturer, but we have been able to use tether some batteries and stuff like this and get to a full hour.
I think they were thinking more of the eye strain was that they were worried about in the it was a VR solution. It was they were like, yeah, you become disoriented and get sick after 30 or 40 minutes.
Yeah, this was one of the, and it is really kind of pushing on the edge of it, of innovation it's been a real fun process because I now know probably more than I had really wanted to know about the human effects of binocular versus monocular. And how long you can look through a monocular without getting dizzy, and vice versa on the binoculars. So it's been a real interesting series of projects. But wearables is one kind of example of things that we work on. It's probably only 20% of what we do. Really, the team is really chartered with anything that adds contextual awareness or content to mobile solutions. So that our mobile users can do their jobs kind of better, faster, and safer. So anything, wearables is nice because you're putting content and context right in their field of view so they can help do their job better, faster. With other mobile solutions, it could be the same way. We've done a lot of work with sensor networks recently, so we can have the mobile app or the mobile solution respond and have the user experience controlled by proximity instead of your standard lists and forms that kind of plague any enterprise or even consumer system.
Can you talk for a second on sensor networks and moats and like how that actually works? What's the mechanism behind that?
Yeah, we did a lot recently with iBeacons, and we of course, as everyone, started in the consumer space and retail with iBeacons, and we struggled a bit to find anything that wasn't just annoying you, or annoying a consumer with pop-ups and stuff. So we actually we developed a prototype on our own, and we took it to one of our major trade shows and showed it to a bunch of customers. And we had one oil and gas company that that kind of sparked an idea with us, and we've since taken that idea and now we've turned it into a prototype, and we're rolling it out. But really, the idea of how do we use beacons to improve safety and kind of drive this contextual, proximity-driven UI. So in this case, obviously safety's, supreme priority in their industry. And they do all the inspections today. They do all the safety checks today. But there's still, mistakes are made because they do the right inspection, but they choose the wrong inspection. They actually walk up and do the inspection on the fire extinguisher, but they pick the wrong one just by mistake in the form or list. So we've added beacons to all of these, and they've worked with hardware manufacturers to get the life.
So example, you walk up to it and knows what it is just based on the location and proximity and automatically cues that data?
Yep.
That's pretty cool, yeah.
And then they just enter the data right there, and they don't make a mistake and choose the wrong one.
Nice. And you mentioned the consumer products. A lot of the consumer space has been leading into the enterprise. How do you guys view that? Is it when you start looking at the example I always think of is Oculus? I feel like Oculus is so far ahead of anything you see in the enterprise, probably for 3 or 4 years. Like, how do you guys view consumer products driving adoption in the enterprise?
Well, I think it depends on the different form factors that come out and the impact that they'll have. I think, in the case of smart glasses, like especially Android-powered smart glasses, there's a whole series that are out. Google Glass is obviously become the Kleenex of the industry. But there's several others. There's Vuzix, there's Recon Instruments that we've worked with, Kopin. There's a whole series of companies out that are making Android-powered smart glasses. And in this case, I really think that the enterprise can step in and play a leadership role in the adoption. I think in a similar way that they did with, the adoption of pagers or even smartphones with BlackBerries. I mean, you still, if you run into somebody in the park, I live here in Atlanta, of course, and there was a gentleman at the park that right down the street from my house would always wear Google Glass, and it was still creepy, so... But the FedEx or the DHL man showing up at your front door dropping a package off is not creepy at all.
Yeah, it's cool stuff. And for you guys, how do customers engage the mobile innovation labs within SAP? Is it just something where if you're an existing SAP customer, you say, hey, I have this mobile idea? Or do you guys work outside of a lot of your existing customers in partnering on these new innovative concepts?
We do work outside of our existing customers, although, with 280,000 customers, we tend to work within our customers.
You guys haven't gotten about 10% of the businesses, so you get a little work to do.
Yeah, we get a little work to do, of course. But no, I mean, the most common way is that they contact us through their existing relationships with SAP, although I am always open to any kind of conversation, so... I'm available on LinkedIn, just Josh Waddell, WADDELL, same Josh.Waddell at SAP.com or JXWaddell at Twitter.
And then for the your groups, you mentioned you guys had a couple of videos or some content, things you've been developing. If people want to go take a look at that, where would they go find that?
SAP Mobile Channel on YouTube.
Cool. Awesome. Well, thank you for having on this morning. Last, Kashi Sehgal is here from Gigabark. And Gigabark is, you probably better explain than me. I say it just helps with texts and phones if you're a doctor's office. But do you want to walk us through what you guys are working on?
Sure. That's a good part of it. But we do a lot of innovative solutions as well. We're an integrated phone and text messaging company. So where we started as just a basic, phone and text broadcast 7 years ago, nobody was really engaged in text message marketing 7 years ago. I mean, even Coke got into it relatively recently, and it's trickled down. But we do a lot. We've built basketball tournament software where it schedules out a bracket play and pool play, and then we'll text you your schedule and point total from the games and all kinds of stuff. So we really turn some kind of operation or marketing element or audience engagement element into an automated function so it can make you more efficient.
What's so. The for you guys is the biggest uptick in the commercial and retail space, or where do you guys see the biggest usage for GigaBark and actually texting, using that medium to contact people?
Yeah, actually, you hit on it when you introduced me. We are seeing a lot more in the healthcare space. There's a lot of innovation to be done there, and you know, you mentioned it before. You know, people are looking to be engaged with. It's no longer this one-way experience, and a text message or a phone call is a very basic element that you can use to engage with your patients, customers, voters, whoever it is. But in this case,
that seems very. I've heard a lot of people recently say, "Don't leave me a voicemail, just text me."
Yeah. Right,
it seems more and more common. And I'm the same way with my dentist. I wish she would. I love those guys, but they always leave me a voicemail. And I'm always in meetings all day, so it's not like I'm going to pick up my phone and check right. a voicemail. And I'm annoyed when it's like, you have an appointment
right.
tomorrow.
I'm always about 24 voicemails in before I actually get through them, and then it takes me forever.
Yeah, so, yeah. yeah. And then for customers, do you guys integrate to software packages? Or are you guys, do you guys have off-the-shelf integrations that people can pick up and buy?
Yeah, so we have an API that anybody can use to integrate our system into their existing network, database, infrastructure, I should say. But we do a lot of custom solutions. And just like Dan said and Josh said earlier about really building that relationship with your customers and doing that needs assessment, we do the same thing. So we really want to know what the customer's end goal is. And every doctor's office is not the same. You want an appointment reminder. You want to decrease your no-show rate. But at the same time, are you trying to be seen as the leading orthopedic institute in Georgia? Well, what does that look like? It is about excellent medicine and excellent service, but do your customers want to feel something different when they come in? So how can we also help you with those experiences and, you know, help deliver information in a way that's more accessible to them?
Yeah, and for you, when you're sending data or text to people, do you guys have to worry about HIPAA compliance, or are you sending
Absolutely.
Typically non-HIPAA? How does that work for you?
You do. I mean, there are things you don't want to send through a text message because anybody can see it. I mean, even on an iPhone, your text message pops up. I'm an Android girl, but your text message pops up on the screen and you see it. So you want to be really careful about what goes through a text message, but that's what the good service providers who are working in this space understand and follow, and we like to think we're one of those.
Awesome. How did you guys get this started? So you said a couple years ago, 6 or 7 years back, you were just sitting around and said, hey, we need an integration service for a text message. What was the origin for you guys getting going?
It's really more my business partner and I have been best friends for a long time and wanted a business together. We both thought we'd own our own businesses one day, and he's a network engineer and was working at all the big companies, Cox, Lucent, Cisco, you know, designing wireless networks and other systems. And I was a consultant, and we both kind of dreamed of having our own thing and decided to put our heads together and figure out something that he could build and I could sell.
Cool. So, and it just turned into this. And then
what
was the big value add that people really clung on to early on?
We really started with phone because 7 years ago, like I mentioned, text messaging was not as prevalent and the big brands weren't doing it. So it was a hard sell. I mean, it was, you know, what is the technology? Then why do you need the technology? And then why you should use us and why it's applicable to you specifically. So those three sales are gone now. It's really more people get why text messaging is useful. They see it in the world and it's not this foreign object anymore. I mean, everybody texts, but texting for business is like a totally different thing. So I think people are more prone to use it now, but they're still a little bit hesitant. I mean, how does it work? Is it personal enough? I mean, you can make anything personal. You just have to make sure you're using it the right way for your customer base.
So personal, cool, not personal, creepy, right? Is that what we talked about earlier?
Right. You can get creepy. You know, we've had customers that have borderline. We always tell them to pull it back. So
nice. And for you guys, when companies want to engage, want to add text and voice interface to their apps or their current service, how do they get, what's the process of them engaging you? They reach out to you, or do you guys have something online you can go sign up?
Yeah, we have a contact form on our website, or they can reach out to me directly. We're gigabark.com or kashi@gigabark.com.
Nice. And the types of customers you guys are looking for, just anybody who wants to text enable or add communication channels to their business?
Absolutely. I mean, this technology is not something that exists in a vacuum. I mean, none of these are like mobile apps, websites, social media, text messaging. All of this should be in a strategy together. So anytime you're looking to enhance something you're doing, even if you're sending an email marketing campaign, sending a phone call or a text message ahead of that campaign can up to double your open rate. It's just a matter of figuring out what your end goal is, and then how can we develop strategies around what you're already using to enhance what's going on.
Excellent. Well, awesome. So Kashia at gigabark.com or gigabark.com. So thank you for having us this morning. So you mentioned just iOS versus Android. What's your preference? You iOS
Android.
Person? Android. All right. Josh?
I'm an iOS guy. Can't give it up.
iOS. Do you have the new giant phone yet?
No, I just have the 6.
I do. And I was getting made fun of about 20 minutes ago, it sounded like. And
my phone's already
done. Is that your new phone?
No, that's my iPad mini, but it's a little bit bigger than yours.
It's about the same size. and then the wearables. Do you have any wearables in the room? No smartwatches yet?
Yes, I have my Fitbit on me.
The one that got recalled, you didn't send back?
No, it doesn't irritate my skin.
Nice. Yeah, I noticed they're releasing a new one before the holidays that I think the first feature is non-skin irritation for the Fitbit. Wearers out there, is anybody going to get the new Google devices, the Moto 360?
We do have several Moto 360s, and what's actually been fun to watch is Ivan, the guy that sits right next to me in Atlanta, was it was quiet in the office, and he started laughing because one of the other team members in Ireland had texted him through Morse code using the haptic within the watch. So maybe there's a Morse codes coming back. I don't know.
Nice. Nerds. Awesome. And then, Kashi, any wearables for you?
No. I mean, I had a Fitbit. I don't wear it as often as I should.
The skin irritation got to you?
It did.
Awesome. And then the, Atlanta-wise. So, Dan, you want to talk about your experience in Atlanta and what keeps you guys here, makes you guys happy in the Atlanta scene?
Well, I think it's interesting to take a look at the history of Atlanta. You know, the foundation of Atlanta was as a crossroads for businesses. It really started out as a B2B town. And because of that foundation, a lot of the companies here have maintained that experience. With that being said, you look at where a lot of business today is going. It's really B2B is in some respects going away, and everything's becoming B2B2C. And what that means is you really need to think of a consumer, even if you're still selling to other to other companies who have one degree separation from the consumer. The reason why we stay in Atlanta is because a lot of those people really have B2B tends to really, really focus very much on what the needs are of the business to achieve success. And ultimately, that is delivering value for the consumers. Now, that sounds a bit esoteric, but keep in mind that when you have to focus on what the business is going to need to do to succeed, then that's going to be driving effective solutions that are marketplace driven. That's an interesting contrast to some other markets such as Austin or San Francisco or New York or even Boston. There's a friend of mine who has a company called Brand Garage, and he runs a lot of hackathons across the country. And he provided an interesting perspective of the types of people that are in Atlanta versus these other markets I just mentioned. There seems to be a lot of people fall in love with the technologies in other parts of the country, as opposed to in Atlanta, people fall in love with trying to figure out the solutions. And I again draw this back to the heritage of Atlanta, which is being B2B focused. I think that lends itself to having this focus on providing solutions for businesses as opposed to just getting enamored with the technology and trying to figure out what the solution is for it. Now, obviously, these are broad-based solutions. I mean, you know, these are broad-based statements, but I think there is some truth to why Atlanta is a good market for mobility and for digital in general and for the technologies that we bring to bear into the marketplace.
It's B2B town. I like it. I'm going to quote you on that one. And then, Kashi, for you guys, what's your attraction to Atlanta? I know, I think you mentioned you and your partner started out here. What kept you here? What are you excited about when you think about mobility in Atlanta?
Sure. Well, first, it's home, so it's good to be here and to see Atlanta grow as much as it has in the technology industry in the last several years. But it's an entrepreneur's town. Coke is such a great story of entrepreneurism here in Atlanta. I mean, it is one of the biggest stories in the world. So is Home Depot, so is AirWatch, so is so many other things that are going on here, and they are all B2B or B2B2C, as Dan put it. So it's exciting to see what's going on here, and the climate just seems so much richer now for ideas to take off and really for innovation. So
awesome. Speaking of innovation, Josh, what's so SAP decided to plop down Mobile Innovation Center in Atlanta? You were tired of traveling other places? How'd that work out?
Yeah, we actually have quite a large presence in Atlanta. If you look at just sheer number of employees, I think we're about 1,800 in Atlanta. Not all focused on mobile innovation, unfortunately, but we have a quite big presence. I mean, for us, we're a global company. The whole attraction of Atlanta as a mobile center, both in technology and in a literal sense with the airport and being able to get anywhere in the world and in a direct flight, is a huge attraction.
Awesome.
So we have tons of great local customers that we work with quite a lot. But really, as a town, it's been great in terms of resources from technology and also with hiring. We've had a lot of luck, and we've gotten a lot of great students out of Georgia Tech or the Human Computer Interaction. A lot of great talent here in town.
Awesome. So talent and customers, those two things definitely make it a good spot for business.
Yeah, and a big airport.
Yeah. Well, thank you guys very much for being on this morning. Kashi, Dan, and Josh, and I think the websites, so the SAP and Razorfish.com and Gigabark,
G-I-G-A-B-A-R-K.
I'm not good at spelling.
It's all good.
Awesome. I'm glad I called it out. Thank you very much. And that's going to wrap it up for today. Thank you guys very, very much.
Thank you.